Well, welcome everyone to the House of the Risen Sun. And the sun is just rising outside my window and probably not at yours yet, Bruce.
No, not for another hour or two.
Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And you will be hearing this, seeing the sun here pretty soon.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see. This. I muted the room so I don't hear myself. Yay. And appreciate Joan taking a little bit extra time to complete the readings of the lessons for the week. She does that every week, does a recap of our weekly lessons, our daily lessons, and it's such a pleasure. So right now, Bruce and I are reading Gary Renard's new book, and I know you have a lot to say about it, but we're still in the intro. The life of Jesus and Buddha knew each other, the history of mighty companions. So how are you doing this morning, Bruce, and what's going on with you?
I'm good, Lynn. Not a whole lot new than just miscellany. Probably not worth buying with the minutia of the miscellany, but of course, that's what we love to do in this world, is make a big deal. You know, much, as Shakespeare said, much ado about nothing, but I'll forego that in preference to jumping into the material that we've been reading for the last two or three weeks now, unless you have some other announcements or anything.
No, not really. No, not
yeah.
at all.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I am going to be having both Gary and Cindy. I'm going to be interviewing them in January.
Okay.
Busy with their new books.
Yes.
This is a hard time, but I'll be interviewing them on ACIM Gather in January.
Okay.
And Gary is sending me a copy. It's so sweet. He said, this is the crazy thing that happened the other night. I just wanted to tell you that we were decorating our Christmas tree and I had put a recording on. And so I came upstairs to check to make sure the recording was playing okay. And I got up here and I had an email from Gary. So I sat down and I read the email from Gary. And he was wanting to send me a copy of his new book, which, you know, I told him, well, I have it on Kindle. And every week, Bruce Rawls and I are going through the book. And when I typed the words Bruce Rawls, my Skype went ga-joink. And I checked my Skype. And Bruce Rawls had, for some reason, unknown to me, but maybe to him, put up a little smiley face on my Skype at the instant that I typed his name.
That's funny, because I don't stay on Skype all day long. I sometimes, you know, just, you know, quit out of the app when I'm not using it, just because of bandwidth issues or whatever, and probably not as much as an issue as it used to be, but it's just kind of an old habit. But I just happened to launch Skype for some other reason, and I saw your comment on there because it shows up as comments that I hadn't looked at. And so I just put a little smiley after your a very thoughtful comment when I can't even remember what it was at the moment, but it's something about probably our last conversation a week ago. And so it's just a further example that minds are joined, and sometimes there's these little coincidences in the script. Little reminders that minds are joined, and that is true for all of us, isn't it?
It is, and it was so weird because I thought, you know how, like, I don't know if you have your smartphone and you have all this little location tracking, and I noticed is that when I went to Hot Topic at the mall, my phone came up and said, how did you enjoy your visit at Hot Topic? Like, it knew I was there because it did. And so I thought, is this some new tracking thing that when I type in Bruce Rawls, that I'm going to get a comment back from Bruce?
Have you seen the movie The Circle?
No, I haven't.
Oh, check it out. It's pretty interesting. It's almost like, what if level confusion with great intentions in a right-minded motivation ran afoul in the world of duality, particularly, you know, the corporate world with sort of archetypes of Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, you know, pick any big, IT corporate giant and kind of imagine an amalgam of those with, the best of intentions, and anyway, it's an interesting film if you haven't seen it, because I think it actually, there's a lot of coarse ideas in there that are, the film shows, you know, a perfect example of what can happen with level of confusions when we try to apply it on the level of form rather than a level of mind, and it backfires in some real interesting ways. And it's a very thought-provoking film, actually, I thought, even though it didn't seem to get very good reviews. It's called The Circle.
And, yeah, it's got a one star at Rotten Tomatoes, so.
Yeah, which is probably, I think it's because there's some threatening ideas in there. That's my thought. You know, it's not a particularly feel-good film in some ways, but in other ways, I thought it was very, you know, eye-opening. And anyway, I enjoyed it a lot, and you might too. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, well, I probably will, because I kind of like that. It looks like a kind of conspiracy theory kind of thing. And, you know, here's something I find interesting, and I'm just going to go a little aside into this, but not too far. The conspiracy theorists, how many years ago was it that they told us, you know, your company's going to want your DNA, the government's going to want your DNA, they're going to be tracking you by your DNA, you're going to be getting opportunities based on your projected lifespan and your health, or you're not going to be getting jobs because you've got markers in your DNA that say this is going to happen or that is going to happen. And people were appalled, and we were like, no, we will not give you our DNA, I don't care what. Now, people are spending hundreds of dollars for kits to send out to get their DNA, and now our DNA is becoming like public, what do they call it, public knowledge or something. It belongs to everybody. So we have asked for what we said we wouldn't stand for. because
I would say it's gone from D&D to DDD, which could be dualistic dream data of our DNA. Maybe that's 4Ds. And but it's interesting how, you know, we again make such a do over nothing in truth, but on the level of form, it's, you know, it's a big deal that, you know, our identities you know, as seemingly separate selves have been now given, elevated to the prominence of, you know, almost, I don't know. Well, they're considered very, very important, in the world. And certainly there's a lot of information that relates to bodies and personas and their histories and the heroes of the dream stories, that can be, you know, extrapolated and interpolated and any other kind of palated, I suppose, from all that data. But it's, you know, it's ultimately, in truth, of no true consequence, because really it's our interpretation, it's the choice of the teacher that we have at any given moment that makes all the difference. And it's so easy to forget that. So, I mean, I'm saying that to remind myself, because, you know, I get caught up in that stuff too, and I have to remind myself, and fortunately I have things like this, you know, weekly Saturday morning schedule with you and three or four other study groups and other routine conversations I've been having. A twice monthly conversation with Jackie Laura Jones on her show, and I have usually monthly conversations with C.A. Brooks and Susan Dugan on you know, a couple of different other programs, and not infrequent conversations with Bob Rosenthal of the Foundation for Inner Peace, and, you know, it goes on and on. And I love all that, because it all those things help me to keep my mind attuned to a teacher that can, if I permit it, keep me aligned with the curriculum of forgiveness, which is really what gets us out of our imaginary predicaments in the world, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's such a joyful thing to have that opportunity. And once it used to be just like, oh my God, here come those terrible thoughts again, here comes this pain again, here comes the rain again, you know.
You're a song lyric there.
Well, you know, I think that's a Eurythmics song.
I think so too.
but it's still, you know, that's it. It's like, you know, it comes back and comes back and comes back because we invite it. Because, you know what, the ego doesn't like not feeling either upset, you know, ecstatic, or, you know, whatever, you know, ego has to have these peaks well, peaks and valleys, because, uh-huh. you know, obviously it needs something to let it know it's alive. And
right.
you see this a lot of times that young people and, you know, people who are disaffected in the world will do things like they'll cut themselves or they'll hurt themselves in order to get a feeling, to have a feeling. And there's, you know, a great song by Nine Inch Nails that Johnny Cash covered called Hurt. And it, I mean, really, it says it all. It's really the ego's tale of how it hurts itself in order to feel alive. And so that all these things that come up, you know, they're really prompts from the ego to pay attention to it and not pay attention to spirit. So every time we have opportunity to, as Emmett Fox calls it, turn the golden key, you know, that's a gift for us to help us to see our truth. But, you know, how often do we fall down the hole and say, oh, geez, poor me, or, you know, yay, I won the lottery, or, you know, whatever things we have that, you know, keep us entrenched in the dream that we would rather pay attention to than our own salvation and the salvation of the world. I mean, when it comes right down to it, because that's what it is. So, yeah, interesting. And I just want to give a shout out to Greg Witham, who is giving a shout out to us on Facebook. Hey, hi, Greg. Good morning, sweetheart. And so happy to have you and, you know, everyone else who's listening to us on the radio, everyone here in the room. Good morning, all. I love you. And I guess I'll let you start reading, Bruce, if you're ready.
Sure. Well, I just, since we tend to meander a bit, but I think this is actually on topic. Yesterday, while I was preparing to take a little break from my usual, you know, steady dose of computer work, I thought, well, I'll go out and clean up some brush piles that were in the driveway and get those out of the way. Well, my wife was visiting some friends in California for a few days and surprise her, you know, because she wasn't expecting that. I thought, I'll just do that. And so I promptly twisted my ankle just as I was about ready to do that. And I thought, okay, well, so maybe it's not the best time to do that right now. It was just, you know, silly. I stepped off, you know, a 1-inch difference between the garage and the driveway and managed to, while not looking where I was standing, you know, just do this. So I thought, well, you know, it's getting better, but it's just kind of like, okay, I guess I'm telling myself that I need a break of a different kind. So I went upstairs and I sat down and I grabbed a book that I hadn't started reading yet, from Ken Wapnick, and it's Love Does Not Condemn. And it's his scholarly, you know, course related treatise on Gnosticism, Platonism, Christianity, and the Course. And I thought, wow, what a perfect time to read this, because if I had picked that up before reading this latest book from Gary, I probably wouldn't have appreciated what's in that, which I'm just really now finding fascinating, because Gary, of course, talks about Plato, and he talks about the Gnostics, and he certainly talks about Christianity in this fourth book. And particularly in the context of the lifetimes of Jesus and Buddha, and how they went through the exercise of looking at these teachings and examining, as well as certainly applying them to their own lives, and taking what worked and gently, you know, saying thank you to the ideas that didn't work, but no thank you kind of thing, as I think we all do, but they were both very steadfast in their persistence in making sure that what they were applying and learning was the truth, and that, you know, was truth with the capital T, in the sense that, you know, it's whatever doesn't change, and whatever doesn't change, as of course A Miracle suggests, is you know, the pure non-duality of the curriculum of forgiveness, and that, you know, that's really how we get back to that pure non-dual awareness that we are, that we've never left the heart of God, except in a dream. And so, anyway, I think it's going to be a fun read. It's, you know, it's a fairly lengthy book as books go, but I'm having fun having just started it. So if anybody has a copy of that or wants to get a copy from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, I know they are still selling their physical inventory of printed books, and you probably could pick it up, I think, for a discount. It's Love Does Not Condemn, and it's the subtitle has to do with Christianity, Gnosticism, Platonism, and of course, in Miracles. And I'm not sure if I got those in the right order, but anyway, should be an interesting experience, and I am looking forward to reading more of that in the context of having just read this book. So,
well, and you know what's really interesting is that these things come to us when it's appropriate, when we mm-hmm. need them, when they are going to help us, and when they're going to give us further insight that yes. we're ready to get. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not just by some accident or happenstance. I was gonna give my wife a gift of a clean driveway, but instead I gave her a gift of a sprained ankle, and now I can read my book.
I was laughing when you said accident because it was, you know, on the level of form, it would appear to be that way. But, you know, it wasn't a bad sprain. It wasn't, you know, it was just enough that I thought, okay, I'll just take a little time off and go upstairs to the recliner that I just moved up there, you know, because we want a little place, a little reading nook kind of a thing. And so I'll put a book up there, you know, so I have something to read when I'm up there. Anyway, so, yeah. More trivial asides, but I think it's all leading back to the idea that we really do have a choice, which is what the previous sentence in the paragraph I'm about to read is, which is on page 24 in Roman numeral 24, in a note from the author about A Course in Miracles in Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other. So I'll read the previous sentence, which is almost at the top of that page, which says, "But if you have things you still want to do here, there is another choice." So you have to read the full paragraph, I suppose, and a few pages back to get the full context, but that kind of prefaces what is next. And this is the choice, of course, that they're talking about. And he continues, "Instead of reacting with the ego, I can stop myself. That's not easy because it goes against everything I've been taught for as long as I can remember." All that ego propaganda, right? "Stopping yourself is particularly difficult for men. Men have a problem called testosterone. If you push me, I'm going to push you back. It's built into the system. Men start wars. It seems that half of us don't know how to do anything constructive. Yet it is possible to make another choice. I can catch myself starting to think with the ego, and I can stop myself. That's the first step in true forgiveness, and that first step is the hardest." I'm laughing because this seems so poignantly funny in the context of the step I took yesterday.
But you couldn't stop yourself.
Well, I did actually. I mean, it's interesting because I started to feel just for maybe 2 or 3 minutes a little self pity, you know, and I caught myself, I thought, oh wow, you know, because I've had episodes in my life, you know, full disclosure, and I don't think too many people are exempt from this, of having gone off into, you know, significant you know, all expenses paid excursions into victimhood, self pity, you know, wallowing in it for, you know, certainly extended periods of hours and sometimes days, weeks, and months, you know. And it's interesting to just kind of watch how the appeal and the attraction for that, because as we were talking about earlier, Lynn, you know, and I think you pointed out very well, is that, you know, the ego strategy is to keep up the propaganda that there's something that needs to be reinforced in that fraudulent identity to keep it alive, whether it's euphoric or you know, a seeming pleasure or seeming pain, but it's the interpretation that says, I exist separate from perfect oneness. I exist separate from my creator. That is the insane propaganda that the ego puts out. And we're in this curriculum to look at that and to see how insane that is. And in this paragraph, Gary happens to be talking about the shall we say, masculine focused version of that propaganda. But the feminine version is equally insane, but it's, you know, he's, you know, making some good points here that I can certainly recognize. Okay, so.
And also, just to kind of back up, you did mention the feminine, you know, the testosterone right now in the American public, is being seen as a pretty bad guy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a public exposure and a widening of the, you know, the little pullback of the curtain of the insanity of, you know, the ego's masculine agenda of, shall we say, grabbing, and harassing and otherwise mistreating, ultimately our own projections, but that's not how we think of it normally. But, you know, we just need to kind of realize how if there's nothing, if we need do nothing in the world, in a sense, in our mind, that's you know, again, you know, watching the craziness play out in the world is an example of how we've, as egos, adopted the idea that we have to do something. We do need, in terms of ego's mandate, to do just all kinds of things in the mind, because we need to keep that thought system going for that propaganda machine to keep working. But once we recognize that that's a hoax, and it's a fraud, and it's a ruse and a sham, and whatever words we can throw out, it's like, well, why would I want to do that? And one of the telltale signs, of course, is the feeling of discomfort. So I had the physical discomfort, and then I had an emotional discomfort, and I was like, wait a minute, okay, I can see where this is going. I've been down this path way too many times. I'm stopping this thing in its tracks. And so I, you know, went upstairs and grabbed a new book, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. There is another way. There is another choice.
You literally turned the page.
I did. Yeah. So let me finish that paragraph. Yeah.
Before you go on, just one more thought.
Sure.
Is that, you know, we're making the testosterone into the bad guy, but you know, I'm a woman. My whole life since a certain age has been run by estrogen. And estrogen is a chemical that causes women to go insane as well. And if you've ever been around someone who had PMS, you might have a clue as to what that is. But I don't see that being used right now to make women into enemies.
No.
As much as the testosterone is being used to make men enemies. But it's all chemicals. That's what we have to understand. People are being affected by chemistry and not having the ability to turn the page or to choose again or not even knowing what that might do or what might mean. They are kind of victims of this chemistry. They are caught up in a whirlpool of anguish that, you know, is it's a painful thing. These hormones cause pain, and they cause people to act outside of their own best interests, and they cause people to say and do things that they would never ever think about saying or doing were they not overwhelmed by these chemicals. And so when you think, if you take the Son of God and cover it up with all this adverse chemistry, what you're going to find is that you have something that is not godly, not loving, not kind, and suffering, really suffering because of that. So, you know, this is why you need to be kind. Talk about the need for kindness. This is why you need to be kind, is because people are overwhelmed by this stuff. Mm-hmm. And unless we ourselves, you and I, who are miracle workers, have our minds straight about these things, if we fall into the fray and we condemn and we get upset and we decide that, you know, people are bad because of these weaknesses, then we join the train. I mean, we're really out to hurt our brothers. And this is why we need to keep our minds straight. So anyway, thank you for giving me that moment, and I will let you continue reading the paragraph.
Yeah, and you made some great points there. And as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, at least a couple of advantages of listening to our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, rather than ego, is that we, as we're watching, you know, this parade of celebrities and sports figures and politicians and yada yada going, you know, and it's just been escalated, but the last couple months has reached a, you know, over the top level of exposés and particularly women coming forward and you know, laying it on the line. Here's what happened and it's I think ultimately a good thing, because it, you know, helps people realize that, you know, there's stuff in the world that needs to be looked at honestly and objectively, and to see truly our egos in action and how insane they are, regardless of whether it's female or male hormones that appear to be the implicated culprit in a dream scenario. I was laughing also because I was thinking about a British sitcom that my wife and I watched several years ago that I've forgotten the name of, but it was really funny. Oh, I know, Coupling, if you haven't seen that. One of the main characters, in response to his partner's complaints about, oh, I can't do such and such, or I behave badly because of hormones. And so that was in an era when that was the comment about women's behavior was justified, but, oh, it's hormones. And so the character in this British sitcom, whenever he behaved badly, he would say, "Oh, sorry, testosterone." and you know, by the way, I'm not doing it justice to the way he delivered it, but it was really hilarious. But it's not only do we, you know, let ourselves and each other off the hook in terms of the spirit, the essence of what we are, and realize that there's nothing to forgive, but it also helps us do what we can do on the level of form, to change our behavior, in ways that are more kind. You know, if we recognize that doing something is going to be perceived as hurtful, you know, why go there? And it kind of ties into your earlier comment, Lynn, about, you know, that the masochistic tendency of the ego to punish itself. And whether it's, you know, physical self-abuse or, you know, which is, you know, usually, you know, just guilt is just anger, you know, turned inward. But anger turned outward is takes the form of all the kinds of, abuse that we've seen in the media recently in terms of, you know, men's overt behavior that is obviously uncalled for, unasked for, and otherwise, you know, on the surface appalling. But it's what's really appalling is that we would invest in a thought system so thoroughly that, you know, we forget to notice that it's actually just silly, you know, and it's not appalling in the sense of, you know, worthy of outrage, but it's worthy of our compassion. Not that, you know, the behavior shouldn't be, you know, dealt with appropriately, and you know, maybe a certain Alabama candidate maybe should not be voted in, you know, but maybe a certain, you know, political figure perhaps might be, you know, one of the factors that contributes to removal from office. Who knows? But the important thing is, if we can remember that every one of these characters, whether it's Al Franken or Lynn or Bruce or any of the aforementioned, you know, politicians or celebrities, we're all perfect spirit in truth. The forms that the dream figures take, you know, movies within movies in some cases, is just an amazingly elaborate holographic script in the mind to get us to see that, and if we use it properly, that these are opportunities to look at the contents of our mind and forgive ourselves and the alleged others that, you know, parade through our mind, whether it's on our phones or televisions or you know, laptops or newspapers or radio or whatever. I mean, it's under our roofs in our offices. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what, one of the things I find so fascinating too is that when I talk with Course in Miracles students about these people, these characters and all the things that they're doing, and every time I say, you have to understand that this person, this Roy Moore person, is so caught up in his own sense of guilt that he cannot see innocence anywhere. And the same, all these people, they feel so guilty for what they do and what they've done and what they live and how they are and all the moral rules that they break all the time, that their own rules. And you know what most people say when I say those kind of things? Oh, he doesn't feel guilty. He doesn't understand. He doesn't know he's doing the wrong thing. He doesn't feel guilty. He thinks he's right. And I, you know, it baffles me how easily we can forget this unconscious guilt that is just the motivator for everyone doing the things that they do in this world, and every single one of us, human being, body, ego, is filled with guilt. Guilt is what makes the illusion possible. It's what makes the illusion what it is. You don't see things in this illusion that are not generated from guilt. Because it's all, the whole tiny mad idea illusion is made of guilt. And that is the fear comes from that guilt. Fear is the cornerstone of every action and activity that we do in this life, whether it's getting up in the morning so I can come in here and share with Bruce, because I wouldn't want to not do it because I would be afraid that, you know, if people would miss me, Bruce would be disappointed, I would feel guilty because I'm staying in bed sleeping. You just have no idea how much of what we do is motivated by a sense of guilt, whether that is a full-blown motivation by a face of guilt or just a little bit, you know, factor in there. But when you start looking and when you look at these guys, and I cannot imagine, and in fact I have a theory, as crazy as it is, that a lot of the stuff that Donald Trump is doing right now, he's doing out of a sense of guilt and a fear of hell. I think that he's doing things that these evangelicals are asking him to do because they believe that that's our salvation, which is, you know, turning Israel over, you know, the Palestinian rights over to Israel, and, you know, basically getting ready to cause a Middle East war here, you know, and we're being protested around the world by Muslims because of that. And you know, I think he's trying to start Armageddon. I think these evangelicals are saying, if you can restore this Jerusalem to Israel, then Christ will come, and all these sinners will be gone. But you, Donald Trump, you know you're a sinner and you're a bad guy, and you've done all these things that are against your own sensibility of morals, but God will save you because you were the one who started all this return of Christ. I think they've got him convinced that his salvation lies in making this thing happen. I may be completely wrong.
Who knows? Who knows? Interesting theory, but it's kind of hard to get in someone else's head, you know. But still, it's like, again, I think what the important to me, right, the important thing of what you're just sharing is that we're all motivated and largely unconsciously by a guilt that we're not even aware of. And I think that's where A Course in Miracles is so brilliant, in that, you know, it helps us to see that, you know, contrary to the popular phrase that love makes the world go round, guilt is really the one that is the thing that makes the world go round, actually literally. But we get... In modern physics, it's probably the last thing they'll ever do is say, well, it's because of unconscious guilt that the universe was made. You know, that is probably the last place you'll hear that out of academia. But certainly the modern physics has given us some interesting insights in the last, you know, better part of a century, you know, that we get to see the reality of the physical world is called into question, but not the motivation for it. Just yet, shall we say. but anyway, the other point, we do have a choice, and that's why I think it really is important. So how about if I'll finish finally this first paragraph.
Okay.
Since we're about halfway through our time, let's see, maybe we can get through a couple pages here. So I'll just start with Gary's comment in the middle of the paragraph. He says, yet it is possible to make another choice. I can catch myself starting to think with the ego, and I can stop myself. That's the first step in true forgiveness, and that first step is the hardest. To take that first step on a consistent basis takes a firm decision to change and a determined effort to get into the habit of thinking with the Holy Spirit instead of the ego. And that is hugely important. I think that just those last few sentences, you know, really is at the crux and at the heart of how important it is to be gentle with yourself. And to just, you know, keep picking yourself off the ground, and sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively, sometimes both, and just say, okay, I'm going forward with the determination to not identify with the ego's blather, because it's just nonsense.
Nope.
Excuse me.
Absolutely, and I think that's it. It's just got to be a determination.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to go on and read the next paragraph because he talks about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Once you've learned to stop yourself from reacting with the ego, which takes the kind of discipline and mind training that is taught throughout the lessons of the course's workbook, you can go on to the next step in forgiveness. Eventually, all three steps will blend into one, and you'll do that habit. So stopping from reacting and with the ego is really kind of the first thing. As a habit, without thinking, having to think much about the steps, you'll just know the truth and think accordingly. This is much like the Zen concept of knowing is as unarticulated truth. But at first, it's essential to learn and practice the steps so you know what you're doing and so you know what it is you're choosing between. That's how the steps become a part of you. And you'll know they're a part of you when you miss forgiveness if you don't do it. One of the reasons for that is you'll know that you are the one who is actually getting the benefits of doing it. And I got to say, for me personally, it is a lifesaver. I know if I just believe what I see and react to what comes in front of me, and I don't question it, and I don't forgive the thoughts about it, then I suffer. But when I do look at them, and I do forgive the thoughts about it, I am happy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a huge incentive.
Yeah. And that reminds me of, you know, another cliche from the course, actually, but it's a good one, and it really is true, is a peaceful mind is not a small gift. Because, you know, that really is at the heart of what the curriculum of, you know, A Course in Miracles, that's why it's, you know, published by the Foundation for Inner Peace, because if we have a peaceful mind, an inner peace, if you will, it doesn't really matter what's going on outside in the dream world that we made up, but what's vitally important is that we utilize everything that seems to come back to us by recognizing it's coming from us, and also recognizing it's coming from a dream identity, and that gives us the opportunity to forgive ourselves for having believed that it was even necessary to choose that dream identity. And so that, I think, is really at the core of this practice of recognizing that it really is nothing to forgive, but we have to look at all the things that come across our path, whether it's a twisted ankle or a sneeze somebody who wants us to take something off the website because they don't want to be associated with it anymore, or you know, it can be all kinds of things. It's just looking at all those things and saying, wow, this is an opportunity to see what part of my mind is projecting something that I need to look at as a reminder of what am I dedicated to? What am I committed to in my mind as an identity? And if we gradually, slowly but surely, by being very patient with ourselves, look at everything that's, you know, crossing our path in the seemingly outside world, realize it's a reflection of our inner world, and it has nothing to do in truth with anybody outside ourselves, we will, like you say, be the ones that benefit, because we will then internalize the lesson by forgiving the decision maker, And of course, the side benefit is we let everyone else off the hook, and that helps everyone, you know, all of creation, all the sonship, as it of course puts it, because minds are joined, and that is hugely helpful because we think we've separated off into these seemingly separate selves, you know, that appear to be, you know, have personas like a Lynn or a Bruce. When we change our teacher, it's hugely important. It doesn't affect what the reality of what we all are in truth one bit. That cruises along unchanged eternally without one hiccup. And is, you know, that reality is blissfully unaware of the goings on of this little dream Whoville drama that we think we're in. But in this little movie, it makes a huge amount of difference to the characters not to the characters in the dream, but to the dreamers that are dreaming that they're these characters, because we get the relief in all those moments that we choose against the ego, and it's identity propaganda, right?
So absolutely, and boy, when you stop believing that propaganda, I think we're learning a lot of stuff about belief and propaganda and what it can cause to people. So, you know, it really is a choice. I love it.
Yeah. Shall I read the next paragraph?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. If you can stop reacting with the ego, you can take the second step and start thinking with the Holy Spirit. First step being looking at the ego and saying, not this time. As I took a few minutes to do yesterday, but it's like, wait a minute, I don't want to go there. So it says, okay, let's start thinking with the Holy Spirit. This step involves what the Course calls the, quote, holy instant, unquote. That's the instant you switch from thinking with the ego to thinking with the Holy Spirit. Now you've made the right choice. And you're always choosing whether you like it or not. You can't think with the ego and the Holy Spirit at the same time. They represent two complete and mutually exclusive thought systems. If you choose wisely, it leads to a totally different experience of life. It can even lead to a better outcome, but that's just an effect. Our focus is on the cause. If you take care of the cause, the effect will take care of itself. The ego has been telling you that what you're seeing is real, that the body is real, that you have a real problem you need to take care of with real people in a real world. Seems real. The Holy Spirit has a totally different story. What you're seeing is not true. And that takes practice to remember that consistently, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's impossible to believe as long as I am identified with this body. So, you know, no matter what I tell myself, I'm just not going to believe it because I have all the evidence to the contrary. So it takes some work to come to believe this.
Yeah. And the work is actually just, I think, sort of a side effect of the decision-making faculty grappling with the uncertainty and the equivocation and the going back and forth. And it's really that friction in the mind between the two thought systems. Because what we really are is completely frictionless. It's completely effortless. It's completely free and peaceful and eternally calm. And that is what we're trying to get back to. But there's that aspect, this little fragmented part of, you know, this fake identity that, and essentially it never happened, you know, which is why there's a Muji video where he describes all the things that go on in the ego mind as nothing, nothing, nothing. And if you haven't seen that, it's a really cool video. Just Google Muji and nothing and you'll see that video. But it's nothing. It's just really a non-identity. But because we've invested so much into it, you know, there's a lot of angst over thinking that we're giving something up. But the only thing we're really giving up is the angst and the suffering and the misery and the continuing to try to beat the dead horse of an identity that never really worked for us.
Exactly. And the fear. I mean, that's the main thing that, you know, no matter what my, you know, how I can talk to myself about things that are happening and, you know, the reality of them and the truth and, you know, forgive, you know, what I think is really happening and recognize that it's not true. When fear is in there, part of the mix, maybe it has something to do with my kids or my health or, you know, something that, you know, as he describes here, I mean, it really comes from the belief in the body,
right.
And the belief that my children's bodies are real, the belief that my pet's bodies are real, the belief that my husband's body is real. You know, these are all these things that come into me that bring me fear, because if I believe that what they really are is that body, then I'm going to be worried that that body is not going to be with me. You know, he's not taking his blood pressure medicine. Better check his blood pressure. What if he has a stroke? You know, these are thoughts that come into my mind really not uninvited, because obviously I do invite them or else they wouldn't be there. And I do tend to believe them or I wouldn't be afraid. And so it's that, you know, constant, you know, you may be okay with, you know, forgiving things in the world and forgiving politicians or forgiving, you know, a lot of other things. But, you know, forgiving the idea that your partner might die or forgiving the idea that your child is sick, that's a lot more difficult because it comes right down to where the rubber meets the road. And that is the belief of what I am and what we are. You know, if I'm not clear on that, then fear is my only real emotion that comes out. And of course it's not real, but you know, that's what I experience. And even love, what seems like love, is really an attempt to control that situation so that I don't have to be afraid. So even things that we look at and say, well, I only did that because, you know, I locked him in his room for 12 years because I didn't want him to get outside and get in fights with people or be picked on, or, you know, I didn't want him to be disappointed, or whatever excuse we use for the things that we do in this world to try to, make it safe, really is that faulty belief in the body as having some meaning in itself and having some use in itself and being all that we are. So it really comes down to this knowing of, you know, what I am, what you are, and how we relate, that is going to shift my thinking into, you know, being able to see the truth about myself and about the world and my brother. If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. It really is that, you know, continued practice, isn't it? Just keep looking at it and not judging realizing that we have that opportunity every moment, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you want me to go on and read the next paragraph?
Sure, why not?
Okay, so you ended with the one that says, the Holy Spirit has a totally different story. What you're seeing is not true, correct? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Aside from describing it as a dream, the Course also describes the ego's illusory world as a projection that is coming from your own unconscious mind. And this is really what's helped me the most, is to see this projection and how I'm doing it. So I like that he's moving into that. Okay, so because you can't see your unconscious, you can't see that you're the one that the projection is coming from. You've made a projection of bodies in a trillion forms of separation. But people are not bodies. They are still perfect spirit at home in God. This has merely been forgotten. The Course asks you, and this is from the Course, and I'm not going to go look at where it's from, because then I'll lose my place. What if you recognize this world is an hallucination? What if you really understood you made it up? What if you realize that those who seem to walk about in it, to sin and die, attack and murder, and destroy themselves, are wholly unreal? I think that's from one of the lessons. Eventually, it would be impossible for you to ever react to the world the same way you used to. And in choosing the Holy Spirit, you would be taking the second of three steps that awaken spirit in yourself. As the Course teaches, the term mind is used to represent the activating agent of the spirit, supplying its creative energy. By choosing spirit, you activate it in your own mind. The Course also teaches that miracles heal because, you need to go to the next page, they deny body identification and affirm spirit identification. And that's it. The miracle denies the body identification and affirms the spirit identification. And, of course, those are miracle principles. Let's see. When I click on that, it doesn't go to where that is, but that is one of the miracle principles. So I think I've said enough, and I'll turn it back to you. Or maybe not.
I think I must have muted my
I think you must have been muted, yeah.
Apologies there. I did look up the quote, the "What if you recognize this world as an hallucination?" And that is from chapter 20, the Vision of Holiness, section 8, in paragraph 7. And this is a not number, but it's about, you know, a third of the way into that paragraph. Put it in context. I'll just read that paragraph. "Judgment is but a toy, a whim, the senseless means to play the idle game of death in your imagination." Once again, Jesus is not mincing any words. He's saying judgment is basically playing the game of death, but it's only in our imagination, right? But vision sets all things right, bringing them gently within the kindly sway of heaven's laws. What if you recognize this world as an hallucination? What if you really understood you made it up? What if you realize that those who seem to walk about in it, to sin and die, attack and murder, and destroy themselves, are wholly unreal? Could you have faith in what you see if you accepted this? And would you see it? And then it goes on, hallucinations, I can say that word, disappear when they are recognized for what they are. This is the healing and the remedy. And it goes on, you know, so don't believe him, basically. He's basically telling us, it's like, you know, don't buy into the idea that this is your reality if it involves space and time and individuality and certainly guilt. That's why I like that GIST acronym, you know, guilt, individuality, space, and time. If any of those things are involved in a significant and, quote, meaningful, unquote, way, you can pretty much figure, you know, you're basically ordering another shipment of ego's propaganda and making home for it in your mind, you know. So,
yep, and charging it to somebody else's credit card. So.
Well, yeah, we try to do that too, don't we? That's the blame game is passing it off on some of the decision making faculty. Yeah. Yep. Anyway, so I'll pick up where you left off.
Okay, I'm going to mute my mic and cough for a while, so okay. Go ahead.
In A Course in Miracles, the, quote, miracle, unquote, is the kind of forgiveness I'm describing, a kind of forgiveness that comes from a place of cause and not effect, the kind of forgiveness where you stop being a victim and start being responsible for your own projection. And he's going to launch another sentence that reminds me of something else that I heard. This is sort of hearsay, but I think it may be based in a cultural precedent. Is I heard somewhere that in not a lot of Native American traditions that if you want to tell your story, you get three times to tell it, and the tribe is very attentive and listening to help you, you know, through your story and ideally out of it. But then after the third time, you're just ignored. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting practice. I mean, not that we should, you know, have a dogmatic approach to being unkind or anything, but I think that the idea behind it is, you know, recognize that if somebody goes on and on with their story, you know, maybe the best thing to do is to, you know, politely nod and move on, kind of thing.
And you know, it reminds me of something that happened, which really was so, so very helpful to me, is when I was at Vicky Poppy's house, staying with her one time, and I told her this story where I was abused or whatever, victimized, whatever, and then you know, we all went through the, you know, forgive this and all that kind of stuff, and then a couple days later, I started thinking about it again. And so I started talking about it again, and Vicky, so gently, what a doll, she just turned to me and she said, "Lynn, You already told me this story once, and I'll listen to it if you want to tell it to me again. But do you really want to keep telling that story? And I was like, oh my God, thank you.
Yeah,
you know, this is what you and I, you know, that might seem rude to a person who's wanting to come and get a bunch of sympathy from people, and they might just say, well, you're mean, you know, why are you, you know, turning me away from, you know, salvation or whatever. But that was actually the kindest thing that could have happened, because she made me realize, oh my gosh, you know, I'm caught up in this story and telling it like it's still happening, and it's happening over and over, and duh, tiny mad idea over and over again. And, you know, once I recognized that, I actually let go of that story, which I just recognized, oh, it's already done, and I just keep bringing it back. So very much helpful. And yeah. And I kind of think this, and maybe I may be overstepping my bounds here, but I generally tend to think that if a person dedicates their mind and wants to be a student of A Course in Miracles, and they come into a room like this, for instance, you know, what I expect that they are going to expect is that I'm not going to pull their leg about anything. I'm not going to let them get by with hurting themselves over and over. I'm going to, you know, ask them, you know, after a while, you already told us the story, you know, do you want to continue on looking at that story, or, you know, are you willing to let it go? It sounds like Lester Levinson kind of thing, but that's it. It's kind of a Sedona method kind of thing. But the reality of it is, if we, who are Course in Miracles students, keep hanging on to our stories and using them, bringing them up whenever it's convenient, and using them to get attention or to get, you know, whatever. I'm not gonna say what you're using your story for, but I'll bet you, you know, unless you're using your story to show how you've let go and forgiven and how salvation came to you through this, that you're going to be continuing to suffer because you continue to think you're being victimized. You know, it's not until you can look at that story and recognize I'm the projector. You know, if it's on my screen, like Carrie Triffitt said one night here, if it's on my screen, it must be coming from my projector.
And exactly.
That's what he says here. You know, that's what we're saying right here.
Exactly.
So let's see, is it you or me now?
I was reading that.
Oh, you're still in the middle of a paragraph.
I'm still in the middle of that paragraph. But it's great because it's interesting, another synchronicity. While you were talking about the Sedona method, just prior to that, a moment or two, I was thinking about how we get opportunities to look at our stories and see how much we want to repeat them, you know, based on your story with about Vicky Poppy being kind. And I had an experience that wasn't direct feedback from others, but it was really in the process of examining my own behavior. I actually gave a bunch of talks and plenary sessions and a workshop at a sacred geometry conference in Sedona, Arizona, actually, in 2004. Almost 14 years ago. Amazing, time flies. And that was before I kind of got back into A Course in Miracles, just a few years before. And in the process of doing that, I made a bunch of friends, and many of whom I'm still in contact with. And a couple of those friends came to visit me when I lived in Northern California. And just, you know, they were there for a few days, and I thought I'd show them around the area. And so I remember driving around and pointing out things that, you know, they might be interested in. But what was interesting is I had lived in that area for a couple of decades at that point. And it was kind of like, not just the been there, done that factor, but it was kind of like I was hearing myself go on and on about, you know, things that may or may not have been of interest to them. I was just trying to be a friendly, good host, tour guide kind of thing. But I was kind of watching my own story evolve in almost through the eyes of these quote unquote outsiders or newcomers to the area. And I was just kind of watching how much meaning I had given to all this stuff And it was a really interesting aha moment that I had. I don't think they ever said a thing because, you know, I was just kind of being a normal guide through, you know, the gold country in the Northern California foothills driving around looking at different things that they, you know, might be interested in, you know, the usual tourist kind of things. And it was kind of fun to watch how I sort of was self-monitoring that conversation and realizing, wow, I need to make it even more about them. And not that I was, you know, not doing that. It was just like I need to really think about what would truly be helpful. And I was kind of, you know, recognizing my inner teacher prompting me. It's like, well, what story do you really want to promote? And you know, what part of your history is really that vital that you need to share it? You know, about this happened at this place and that happened at that place and you know, whether it was me or some historical figure from the area, it's like, you know, how important is all this? But it was just kind of interesting, eye-opening experience. So, and these were friends from Sedona, so it's another small world synchronicity here. Yeah.
Oh, funny, yes.
Well, that I met in Sedona. They actually lived in Las Vegas here at the time. So, okay, let me finish this paragraph as we tend to meander a bit. okay. It's talking about being stopping being a victim, being responsible for our own projection, which you were just saying. Native Americans have often said, "Behold the great mystery," end quotes. A Course in Miracles says, quote, "Behold the great projection," unquote, because that's all the universe of time and space is. As some disciplines have taught for thousands of years, it's all an illusion. You may not be able to see where the projection is coming from, but you can undo any effects the projection has on you by withdrawing your belief in it, which gives it power over you. And I think that belief and that identity that we've invested in these dream figures is so profound that we don't realize the depth and breadth of it. And, you know, the ontological guilt really that's motivating it. Because without that belief that we, you know, done somebody wrong, somebody being God or perfect oneness or whatever we want to call it, you know, the spirit of total inclusion, we somehow think we shattered that and we, you know, need to feel horrible about it, but it never happened. And we've pulled the wool so far over our eyes that there's not much light getting through, but, you know, slowly, if we slowly open our eyes and, you know, the dawn, approaches gradually as it is out my window as I'm speaking. You know, it's not this abrupt thing that startles us and frightens us. You know, kind of like how I know Gary has just used this analogy from the Course as well, that, you know, if a child is having a nightmare, you don't shake the hell out of it. You just whisper gently and you're just dreaming. It's okay. You know, all the stuff that seems to be happening hasn't affected your reality one bit. And it's, you know, you're going to be fine and just trust that, you know, you're waking up and you're still going to be having, you know, distorted perception for some time. But, you know, just remember that this is a dream and you can afford to, you know, laugh gently at your thoughts that make it real. And you'll be able to do that more and more over time as you, you know, become more mindful. So anyway.
Exactly. And in the dream, you know, when you and I see a person who is having difficulty because they believe in the dream, they believe in the reality of the body, they're in fear of the world, you know, we don't walk up to them and shake them and say, "Hey, wake the hell up. Don't you know this is a dream? It's an illusion." Even if they're Course in Miracles students and they say, "I believe it's a dream and illusion, but geez, you know, why doesn't, you know, Trump resign? Or why don't, you know, or why did this happen?" Or what? You are mixing metaphors. Really, is what you're doing. If we are not single-minded in our focus on this, then how can I expect, if I'm not, how can I expect to be able to see the truth of what it is if I keep insisting that the reality I made for you is the truth? If I insist that the ego I see when I look at you is what you are and therefore I'm going to attack it, that just, everything's down the tubes then. You can't live in both worlds. So you can't say, "I love you, brother, you're the Christ, but gee, are you a jerk?" You know, those things don't go together because either he's the Christ or he's a jerk. And I can guarantee you, if he's the Christ, he's not a jerk. And if he's a jerk, he's not accepting or knowing his own truth and reality as the Christ. So either way, it doesn't help me or anyone else if I attack him. It certainly doesn't help him if I attack him. So this is why, you know, you have to really look at your motivation for what you're doing and saying, and what you're deciding is important to pay attention to and what not. Because anytime you get caught up in the world and the mechanism, the operating system, the ego part of it, and make it your reality, then you are never ever going to see the truth of who you are. And even Jesus tells us, and this is one of my favorite sections, back in chapter four, section four, I have to look here to be real sure, where he says to us, you know, I will substitute for your ego, if you'll let me. That means you can let go of the minutiae of the world and stop worrying about, are you going to make it to your appointment on time? Do you have enough money in the bank? You know, are you going to get, the flu because you were sitting next to somebody on the train that had the flu? You know, whatever it is that you think is happening, you know, if you continue to want to believe that what is happening to you is the truth, and you are, I think it's section five, the ego body illusion, where he talks very clearly about how it is that it's our own election to believe in or think that we are this ego, but and it's not that section. I don't know where it is. I always talk about it too. But he says, "I'll do it. I'll take over for your ego. I'll substitute for everything." So if you're worried about you're going to be late, just say, "Jesus, you know, take care of this." If you're worried that you don't have enough money, you just say, "Jesus, take care of this." And you stop worrying about it, and you stop thinking about it, and you turn it over. That's what turning it over means. I'm not holding on to it. I'm giving it to you. And if we give it to him consistently, or the Holy Spirit, or our inner kindness teacher, or whatever, consistently give that away, give that away, give that away. Anytime we feel worried or uncomfortable or afraid or you know, whatever, hungry or sad or, you know, cold. I mean, think about, you know, if my body feels cold, that's a reaffirmation that my body is real. And so if I just say, I'm not going to mess with this, please take care of it. You know, we're not turning Jesus into a servant, which I think a lot of people might think. What we're doing is turning over the minutiae to the one who will manage it, mainly because the ego system, the script that came out of the tiny man idea does not change. The script is not changing. Now you might move into a different part of the script, I think is what happens when you practice forgiveness. You move into a part of the script where there's more joy, less fear, and more confidence that everything is being taken care of. You see that evidence in your life because you are willing to let it go and stop trying to hold on to it yourself. So, you know, this idea, this ego body illusion is probably one of the most important things that we need to understand, because once you give it up, the idea that the ego and that the body has a value in itself, and that you must protect and defend it and support it and feed it and water it and groom it and all those kinds of things. You know, if I am busy doing all those things, then I am not paying attention to the truth of what I am, which is not the body. So that doesn't mean you just stop eating, drinking, combing your hair, taking a shower, going to work. None of those things happen, because when Jesus is running stuff, you get to work on time. if that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, I've had Jesus slow trains down, speed buses up. You know, I've had Jesus do a lot of stuff that, you know, once I turned it over to him, everything worked out perfectly. But it was beyond, it defied gravity. It defied my belief in how it could be or should be or how it should be done, because I really didn't know. But, you know, once I let it go, it got done. And it probably would have gotten done this either way, except for the factor that's missing is the personal responsibility and the worry that comes from thinking I have to run the clockwork of the illusion. It'd be like if I got up every morning and said, all right, I'm going to tell my heart to beat every, you know, 86 times a minute. Every time I think about it, that's I'm going to tell my heart to keep beating. Yeah, that's real fast. I don't know. Let's go really fast. But you're not telling your body to breathe. You know, sometimes you tell your body to breathe and sometimes you tell your body not to breathe. How often can you tell your heart to stop? How often can you tell your blood to stop going through your veins or, you know, stop your fingernails from growing or start your fingernails growing? You have no control. This is, once you realize that you really have no control, and in reality, you do not want control.
You mean there's not a user interface setting somewhere that has a little checkbox and radio buttons for all those things? I thought
there's not. No, it does not exist, Bruce.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe there's a control panel I hadn't figured out yet.
No, that control panel is not accessible by you. So, okay. So quit it. All right. So let's see. Where are we at? Are we at the dream is not being dreamed?
By someone else. Now, I did have a couple of comments that I was going to make.
One is,
you were talking about metaphors earlier, and I have a favorite paraphrasing of a Will Rogers quote, which is, I never metaphor I didn't like, meaning that if I can remember that everything in my seemingly external world is a metaphor for some aspect of my mind that I'm being shown as part of my forgiveness classroom, then I can give appropriate appreciative response to everyone and everything, because everyone and everything is really calling for love or expressing it, and so therefore it doesn't merit condemnation. And I like that book title I've just started of Ken Wapnick's Love Does Not Condemn. And therefore, you know, every metaphor, whether it's a animal, mineral, vegetable, or human, or whatever, that comes into my life is a feedback mechanism, becomes an opportunity for me to grow and to return, you know, grow in my strengthening conviction and identification with that inner kindness teacher. And that is a wonderful thing. So you know, bring it all on. And then to your other comment about, you know, I think the quote that maybe you were thinking of that perhaps was the one where something like, I think it's pretty early in the text too, that Jesus says, you know, I will arrange space and time on your behalf, or something like that. And I have an interesting, a quick story. When 25 years ago, when my wife and my mom and several other friends were in Egypt on tour with Greg Braden, we went to Mount Sinai as part of that tour through the, you know, interesting places in Egypt. And the bus driver on the way back made phenomenally good time getting us back into Cairo. We were supposed to, when we left Sinai that morning, get back into Cairo late afternoon, and we ended up getting there early afternoon. And there's actually a governor, which is, you know, a mechanical device that limits the speed of the bus so that it physically cannot travel faster than a certain number of miles per hour, right? And so what was happening when we pulled into Cairo, there was, even then, there were places where, you know, there were, you know, military, you know, checkpoints and things like that. And we actually had a military escort in this bus because we were traveling through a certain region that, you know, probably wasn't as friendly to, Western tourists as other places in Egypt. And anyway, it was interesting, but overall our experience was the Egyptian people were incredibly friendly. But the interesting thing about this story, which was written about in one of Greg Braden's books, he put it together, is, you know, this is where, you know, perhaps time and space were modified so that we could all be there or at, you know, at earlier and have a chance to explore, you know, the Great Pyramid, which is what we did that afternoon. If my memory serves properly, or maybe it was something that we were avoiding, and who knows? You know, we don't know what happened, but it was kind of interesting that the bus driver and the tour guides were kind of like freaking out. It's like, wait a minute, we're not supposed to be here for another 2 or 3 hours, and how is this physically possible? You know, because they, you know, they run their buses on a pretty routine schedule kind of thing, and they've, you know, done that a bunch of times, and so they was like, well, what happened here? So yeah, I mean, because this is a dream, there are cases where, you know, maybe the dream circumstances are bent a little bit here and there. But we don't have to be concerned about that. And I think that's the whole point, is that if we can let the Holy Spirit, a.k.a. Jesus, a.k.a. Our inner kindness teacher, take over the worries and concerns in our mind, it doesn't mean that we don't do the usual behavioral things and you know, obey the world's laws or the political and cultural, you know, niceties and thoughtfulness and so forth and you know, and brush your teeth, come here, you know, I hear all that kind of normal stuff. It doesn't mean we don't do those things. It just means we do it with a different attitude, with just a gentle inner smile. It's like, well, this isn't the reality. This is not the real deal. If we can remember that more often, you know, it does change things. It does loosen our grip, our identity-wise, on a dream figure, and returns us to being a dreamer, which is where we have the choice, the real choice. Exactly. You want to read the next paragraph?
And you had to get on the bus. That's the thing. You wouldn't have been getting to Cairo if you didn't get on the bus. So, mm-hmm. You know, that had to happen. But
but
the rest of it, you know, you got, and that was also the guidance. And I did find it, chapter 4, section 1, I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
Chapter 4, section 1, paragraph 13 says, I will substitute for your ego if you wish.
Ah, yes, I remember that.
But never for your spirit. A father can safely leave a child with an elder brother who has shown himself responsible, but this involves no confusion about the child's origin. So he's our elder brother, but we are his brother. We're the same. The brother can protect the child's body and his ego, but he does not confuse himself with the father because he does this. And then Jesus says this most astounding thing. He says, I can be entrusted with your body and your ego only because this enables you not to be concerned with them and lets me teach you their unimportance.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I couldn't understand their unimportance to you if I had not once been tempted to believe in it myself. Let us undertake to learn this lesson together so we can be free of them together. I need devoted teachers. This stuns me, he says, this chapter 4. I need devoted teachers who share my aim of healing the mind. Spirit is far beyond the need of your protection or mine. And then he says, remember this, in this world you need not have tribulation because I have overcome the world. That is why you should be of good cheer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The deep stuff came to the world and he's willing to take it on and do everything for us.
He's applying the McFerrin prescription of don't worry, be happy.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Shall we read one more paragraph quickly?
Yes. Let me go ahead and read the next paragraph.
Okay. And then we'll have completed two whole pages.
I don't have pages, so I don't know.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. The dream is not being dreamed by somebody else. There is nobody else, only the projection. If anyone or anything in this world, and for those of you who just came in, we're reading from Gary Renard's new book, which is When Jesus and Buddha, the lifetimes of Jesus and Buddha lived together. He says, there is nobody else, only the projection. if anyone or anything in this world has the power to hurt you, it's because you've given it that power. Now it's time to take that power back and put the power of belief where it belongs, in God. Over time, this changes everything. The Course says miracles are habits. Your mind is being retrained to forgive instead of judge. And that's it, the mind training.
Bingo. Yeah, that's it. It's real simple, being retrained to forgive instead of judge. If we could just remember that more and more each day, got it made. I like the quote that you read from chapter 4 too, because it kind of reminds us that you know, Jesus and Buddha, as this book points out, Gary's fourth book, you know, we're going through the same kind of stuff that you and I and everyone else that's a spiritual seeker go through, of returning to that awareness. And there's very obvious steps in that process that we go through, and we can afford to be gentle with ourselves when we realize that, you know, they have the same kind of challenges and opportunities and learn the same kind of things together, that help them go beyond the belief in this crazy thought system of the ego, and just finally, together, you know, release it, you know. So that was, it's a wonderful book. If you want a copy of it, I have a link to it on ACIMblog.com, and also another interview with Gary and Cindy about both of their recent books. And I hope we can continue next week. I think we're all down to about the last 7 pages of just this note from the author. maybe by the end of the year we'll finish it, huh?
I think it's a rich note, so I'm glad we did.
Yes, I think it's great that we're taking time to go through it, because there's so much in this introductory note that is really a wonderful summary. But each paragraph is really rich, as we've discovered, because we keep finding great things to share and relate that support that, don't we?
Exactly. So before we go, I have a couple of little short announcements. Dove Fishman and I will be speaking together at the ACIM conference in San Francisco in February. So if you haven't already gotten tickets, there's still, I think some people still have some discount tickets, and we might be able to find them back to $3.99, which was the original price.
Oh, I might be interested. Yeah.
Dove and I are going to be speaking there, and a lot of other folks. There's like 29 or 28 different speakers that are going to be there. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And then next year on Columbus Day, the Columbus Day weekend, John Mundy and Dove and I will be part of the program in Stony Point, New York. We're going to have a workshop there, and part of the workshop we're hoping is to get a bunch of ACIM Gather teachers and members to show up for a reunion. Oh, Dove says $4.99, and now it's $5.99. So the discount tickets were $4.99. Now they're $5.99. That includes, that's like, what, 3 days, meals. It's going to be awesome. But that's the Course in Miracles conference. The ACIM Gather reunion, I'll be getting more information out on that. But we're hoping to do it next year on Columbus Day. So it's going to be in New York. If you happen to be in the area, we'd love to see you. And we might do a local, you know, that's what I'm thinking. We might do fairly local reunions for GATA, because we have people all over. And so I'd like to hit the, you know, kind of Southwest area, maybe get some folks from Texas and Arizona and California and whatever to come at another time. But, you know, like to get you all together and see your shiny faces. I love it. All right. Thank you. And yes, I will send you that link.
Okay.
All right. So, thanks again, Bruce Rawls.
And likewise, Lynn Johnson. No, that's pretty much it. Again, we've been reading from Gary's fourth book. If anybody's interested, there's an interview with Gary and Cindy on the ACI blog, and I look forward to talking next week.
Very good. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And I'm going to stop this recording and turn the mic over to you, Barb and Devin.